Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight, the show that invites you to attend on Cambridge Community Radio, Cambridge 105, with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson. You can find me at the other end of Lamplight at cambridge105.fm or at the website momentsunderlamplight.com, where you'll find podcasts and archives of our shows. This evening under Lamplight, we invite you to attend to eyes, vision, sight, even insight. There are lots of good songs and a few interesting poems for us here. First, let's look at different kinds of eyes. And first of all, the ways the eyes are so entwined with sexual attraction. The eye is the light of the body and is the most powerful expression of our passion. And thus, the eyes can be like magnets that draw us towards someone else, as in our first song, Sexy Eyes by Dr. Hook. This is one of those songs that seem to come from the lonely fantasies of adolescent boys. There are lots of songs like that. Whether because that's what will sell or because these are the kind of fantasies that rock singers have to draw upon, I don't know. But Dr. Hook is always good in portraying self-pitying songs. Remember Sylvia's mother. And here we find this boy just sitting all alone, watching people getting on with each other, dancing together, lovers. "But one more lonely night for me," he sighs. And just then he looks up and sees sexy eyes moving across the floor. That got him wanting more, and in this fantasy he approaches her, and it doesn't take long until they fall in love. "No more lonely nights for me," he crows. Yep, it's not one of their Shel Silverstein songs, and therefore there is less verbal wit than usual. But the wit comes from the music, and I suppose also from just having the nerve to treat such a fantasy so seriously.
They were dancing across the floor.
That version of Sexy Eyes comes from Dr. Hook's album Sometimes You Win. There's a different version, smoother and shorter, found in their Best Of album. Well, that was a song about a boy falling for a girl's sexy eyes. Let's switch around, as here the woman, Billie Holiday, falls for the man's sexy eyes. Them there eyes. I fell in love with you, she says, the first time I looked into them there eyes. And you have a certain cute way of flirting with them there eyes. They make me feel so happy, they make me feel so blue. Fallen, no stallin', in a great big way for you. My heart is jumping, you started something. These eyes are dangerous because they exert such power over her, but there's also a sense in which, given the way they sparkle and bubble, they're going to get the guy, too, into a whole lot of trouble. You're overworking them. There's danger lurking in them, their eyes. But these lines are not in the version we're going to hear. Instead, we learn something else. What do these eyes tell us about the guy? Well, he's the boy with the wistful eyes. Wistful eyes, full of dreamy longing, perhaps the eyes of the Dr. Hook adolescent. But I'm not sure that wistful is the word she sings. It might actually be the boy with the whistle eyes. He uses his eyes to give the girls the whistle. That's an odd image, but it fits the sassiness of Billie Holiday's performance and her usual defiance, even if doomed defiance, of big shots who think they can get on top of her. She's in danger, yes, but he'd better look out, too. Getting involved with her may be more than his cockiness reckoned on. Well, here's Billie Holiday with them their eyes, and of course we want to attend to her beautiful voice and the way it plays across many different emotions.
I fell in love with you the first time I looked into them their eyes, and you have a certain little cute way of flirting with them their eyes. They make me feel so happy, they make me feel so blue. I'm falling, no stalling, in a great big way for you. My heart is jumping, you started something with them their eyes. You'd better look out, little brown eyes, if you're wise. They sparkle, they bubble, they're gonna get you in a whole lot of trouble. Oh, baby, them their eyes. Them
That was Billie Holiday, Them There Eyes. And here's one more song about eyes as sexy signposts. We're back in the loneliness of Dr. Hook's sexy eyes, but like the Billie Holiday song, we hear a woman singing about the way a man's eyes have captured her and turned her from lonely to joyful, or rather zufrieden, because this is a song in Yiddish. The song is called simply Eugen, or Eyes, and it was written by the great Yiddish actress Molly Picon, who sang it in the film Eins und Rechts, or One in a Million. The song is sentimental. What do we expect from a 1930s musical? But it's not quite an adolescent fantasy like the Dr. Hook song, if only because of its extravagant imagery and because the song recognizes that the world does not get suddenly all right, but that this new love also brings pain and subjugation to the powers of love, the powers of those schwarze Augen, those black eyes. Here are the words in English. It's a dark night, and I sit and think that my life is worthless. It's empty and hollow, my aspiration useless. There's no luck in my cards. But suddenly a ray of light, a bright source, I caught sight of two eyes. I soon felt that my heart was lost, but I was happy. Eyes, for your dark eyes. Before them the bright sun bows down. Eyes, for your dark eyes. They pulled my heart to you, and I became enslaved for life, captured and amazed. And I will aspire to fulfill all their desires. Eyes, for your dark eyes. The world will no longer have any worth without your dark eyes. Okay, got it? Fa dein schwarze Augen. Here's Faye Kellerstein to sing it for us with a Latin dance floor rhythm.
Sehr finstere Nacht, und ich sitz mir und tracht. Mein Leben hat gar nicht kein Wert. Sie's ledig und pust, mein Streben ums ist. Kein Masel ist mir nicht beschert, nor Plitz im Astral, a lichtiger Qual. Zwei Augen hab ich der Sein. Ich hab bald erfüllt, mein Herz ist verspielt, nur ich bin zufrieden gewesen. Schwarze Augen, vor sie steht ein Gebeugen, die lichtige Sonne. Augen, vor deine schwarze Augen, sie haben zugezeugen, mein Herz und ich bin. Verschlaft geworden auf mein ganz Leben, vergafft geworden, und ich will streben, alles sei zu geben. Eugen, von einer schwarze Eugen, die Welt wird mir nicht teugen an deine schwarze Augen. Musik. geworden. Und ich will streben, alles sie zu geben. Eugen, für deine schwarze Eugen. Die Welt wird mir nicht trügen um deine schwarze Eugen. Eugen, für deine schwarze Eugen. Sie steht eingebogen, die lichtige Sonne. Eugen, vor deine schwarze Eugen, sei oben zu gezeugen, mein Herz und ich bin versklavt geworden, auf mein ganz Leben. Verkauft geworden und ich will streben, alles sei zu geben. Eugen, war deine schwarze Eugen.
Thank you, Faye Kellerstein, mit Eugen, a jiddischer Lied für uns. Die Welt wird mir nicht teugen an deiner schwarzen Eugen. The world will be worth nothing more without your black eyes. We'll come back to black eyes, or at least dark eyes, a little later. And here we are with Evening Under Lamplight, on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in Cambridge, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, as we attend to various aspects of eyes. Now, let's forget eye color and attend for a moment to eye quality. Do you have poor eyesight? Do you need glasses? Well, be sure to get ones that do not encourage others to laugh at you. Make your own choices. Even wear pince-nez if you want to. But our next song speaks about the problems of a kid whose parents determine what kind of glasses he will wear. It's no fun. This is an unusually bitter song by John Sebastian, always known for wearing what came to be known as John Lennon glasses. But he may have been wearing them before Lennon. He chose them. But obviously, judging from this song, he had no choice about his glasses when he was young, and he's still angry about that. So angry, in fact, that he cannot speak from his own perspective, but, in the refrain, takes on the role of the bullies who haunted him like this. Four eyes, and what you gonna do now? Four eyes, and how much do you see now? How many fingers? Ha, ha, ha. When your kids you see through plastic with a harness of elastic, so the girls all think you're icky, and the boys all think you're queer, and the hinges all get rusted, and the seventh pair gets busted, so you graduate to tortoiseshell, which makes you look severe. When you're so blind they call you Batman, you can't even see a fat man, you can't dig just where he's at, man, without windows on your eyes. But the frames ain't your decision. And they're fitted with precision, so they magnify your eyes like they're a pair of cherry pies. And then, to conclude, a word of advice to the parents. Here's a word to all you parents. Give a break to little Clarence. When he says the blackboard's fading and the world's a fuzzy place, Mr. Upper Middle Classes, let the baby choose his glasses. And please recall that, after all, he wears them on his face. Take it away, loving spoonful, with four eyes.
Four eyes, what you gonna do now? Four eyes, and how much do you see? Ha ha ha!
when your kids in see-through plastic with a harness of elastic. So the girls all think you're icky, and the boys all think you're queer. Then the hinges all get rusty, and the seventh peg gets busted. So you graduate to tortoise shell, it makes you look severe. All right, what you gonna do? And they magnify your eyes like they're a pair of cherry pies. All right, what you gonna do now? What you gonna do? All right, and how much do you see now? How many fingers? Ha, ha, ha. Here's a word to all you parents. Give a break to little Clarence when he says the blackboard's fading and the world's a fuzzy place. Mr. Up in middle classes, let the baby choose his glasses. And please recall that after all, he wears them on his face. All right, what you gonna do now?
That was Four Eyes by the Loving Spoonful. Don't you love that song? I've loved it for years and years. The song isn't really about having bad eyesight, is it? It's about having parents take charge of a kid's looks. But I want to move on to the subject of bad eyesight, in fact, to blindness. Now, this is a serious subject, but there are ways and ways of treating it. The most serious moral issues we were taught at Amherst College, as I was aware of it, had to do not with actions, but words. How do we talk about something? Is it appropriate in tone and style to this situation? I want to read you a poem that illustrates, according to this Amherst morality, an immoral way of speaking about blindness. William McGonagall's poem, The Sorrows of the Blind, is a really bad poem. In fact, McGonagall was known as the best bad verse writer in English. He wants to write a poem praising our sympathy for the blind, but he does so in simplistic, cliched, platitudinous language, and his only concession to the form of poetry is somehow to make sure that every pair of lines rhyme, no matter how badly the meter comes out. We therefore laugh at the poem and feel bad that we may be laughing at blind people, but we're not. Laughing at this poem is a way of taking blindness seriously and dismissing stupid ways of speaking about it. I'll read it and you can see what I mean. Pity the sorrows of the poor blind, for they can but little comfort find. As they walk along the street, they know not where to put their feet. They are deprived of that earthly joy of seeing either man, woman, or boy. Sad and lonely through the world they go, not knowing a friend from a foe, nor the difference betwixt day and night, for the want of their eyesight. Excuse me a second, can I just remark that you cannot end a line with a two-stress word like eyesight, eyesight, especially if the two syllables have the same vowel sound. It makes the line thud. But notice that this does not stop McGonagall from doing it several times in the poem. The blind mother cannot see her darling boy. That was once her soul's joy. By day and night, since she lost her precious sight. To her the world seems dark and drear, and she can find no comfort here. She once found pleasure in reading books, but now pale and careworn are her looks. since she has lost her eyesight. Everything seems wrong and nothing right. The face of nature, with all its beauties and livery green, appears to the blind just like a dream. All things beautiful have vanished from their sight, which was once their heart's delight. The blind father cannot see his beautiful child, nor wife, that was once the joy of his life, that he was wont to see at morn and night, when he had his eyesight. All comfort has vanished from him now, and a dejected look hangs on his brow. O kind Christians all, both great and small, pity the sorrows of the blind. They can but little comfort find. Therefore we ought to be content with our lot, and for the eyesight we have got, and pray to God both day and night to preserve our eyesight, to be always willing to help the blind in their distress, and guard us by night and day, and remember us at the judgment day. That was William McGonagall, the self-proclaimed poet and tragedian, Bard of Dundee, followed by Taj Mahal and Blind Boy Rag. But now to move on to something a little more serious, our Kinks song called Killer's Eyes. Killer Eyes usually refers to the kind of flirty eyes we were looking at earlier, but not in this song. These are the eyes of a real killer. I don't know what motivated Ray Davies to write this song. It's a kind of inside view of the stories we read and watch on the news. It's spoken by the family of some serious killer, whose picture, complete with his killer's eyes, has appeared in the paper and on television. What do they make of it, his family? "We've seen your picture in the paper. Your little sister's pinned it on the wall. She thinks you're in some kind of movie. Imagine her surprise when she saw you on the news. Reporters came around and asked for interviews. How could we know what it was like inside a killer's mind? It never really showed. You kept the secret deep inside those killer's eyes." It's not an easy song, as you can imagine, but we're going on quite a journey this evening under lamplight, and we can attend to this too.
I see so little hope in you, but so much despair. As I look in your eyes, I wonder what thoughts linger there. Life means nothing to you, at least that's what they say. But it doesn't mean that you have the right to take life away. How are we to know what was going on inside your mind? You never let it. What was going on behind those killer's eyes? Killer's eyes. We've seen your picture in the paper.
was a slum, but you haven't got the right to blow it to kingdom come. How could we know what it was like inside a killer's mind? It never really showed. You kept the secret deep inside. Those killer's eyes. Killer's eyes. You say the world is full of bullshit, so you kill just as you see fit. They say you're a fanatic with a mission. We all go through hell in some kind of way. Can you tell me what it's like to be there every day? When you were young, you had a vision. Why'd you go and do a thing like that? And now we see you on the television. Imagine how surprised when you saw you on the news. As I look in your eyes, I wonder what was lingered there. Life means nothing to you, at least that's what they say. But it doesn't mean that you have the right to sleep right from away. When you were just a child, you cried the way that other children cry. But it doesn't mean that you have the right to take life away. Those killer's eyes. I see the whites of your eyes. Those killer's eyes. I see the whites of your eyes.
Those killer eyes see the whites of their eyes. But now let's turn it around and look not at the whites of the eyes, but at dark eyes again. We were discussing Raymond Chandler's novel The Big Sleep in class recently, and Christina said she'd been attending to the characters' eyes as ways of understanding the characters. She noticed that all the Sternwoods, the rich family behind all the complications of the plot, Stern and Wooden, that they all have dark eyes. Watch how dead they are, these filthy rich people with no true life in them. In the second chapter, we follow Marlowe, the private detective, who has been called to the mansion of the aged General Sternwood to do a job for the old man. The impassive butler leads him out to the stifling greenhouse where the general is to be found, the greenhouse reflecting the overlush, stifling world Marlowe is being asked to clean up. The butler opened a door for me and stood aside. It opened into a sort of vestibule that was about as warm as a slow oven. He came in after me, shut the outer door, opened an inner door, and we went through that. Then it was really hot. The air was thick, wet, steamy and larded with the cloying smell of tropical orchids in bloom. The glass walls and roof were heavily misted, and big drops of moisture splashed down on the plants. The light had an unreal greenish color, like light filtered through an aquarium tank. The plants filled the place, a forest of them, with nasty, meaty leaves and stalks like the newly washed fingers of dead men. They smelled as overpowering as boiling alcohol under a blanket. The butler did his best to get me through without being smacked in the face by the sodden leaves. And after a while, we came to a clearing in the middle of the jungle under the domed roof. Here, an old red Turkish rug was laid down, and on the rug was a wheelchair, and in the wheelchair, an old and obviously dying man watched us come, with black eyes, from which all fire had died long ago, but which still had the coal-black directness of the eyes in the portrait that hung above the mantel in the hall. The rest of his face was a leaden mask, with the bloodless lips and the sharp nose and the sunken temples and the outward-turning earlobes of approaching dissolution. His long, narrow body was wrapped in that heat, in a traveling rug and a faded red bathrobe. His thin, claw-like hands were folded loosely on the rug, purple-nailed. A few locks of dry, white hair clung to his scalp like wild flowers fighting for life on a bare rock. How do you like that? Black eyes from which all fire had died long ago, but which still had a coal-black directness. Well, Sternwood's daughters are both trouble, as represented by their troubling dark eyes. The older daughter, Vivian, Mrs. Regan, has hot black eyes. And they may be hot, but they're not giving anything away. She tries to find out why her father sent for Marlowe, but Marlowe is giving nothing away either. There's a wonderful contest between these two. I grinned at her with my head on one side. She flushed. Her hot black eyes looked mad. "I don't see what there is to be angry about," she snapped. "And I don't like your manners." "I'm not crazy about yours," I said. "I didn't ask to see you. You sent for me. I don't mind your ritzing me or drinking your lunch out of a bottle of scotch. I don't mind your showing me your legs. They're very swell legs, and it's a pleasure to make their acquaintance. I don't mind if you don't like my manners. They're pretty bad. I grieve over them during the long winter evenings. But don't waste your time trying to cross-examine me." She slammed her glass down so hard that it slopped over on an ivory cushion. She swung her legs to the floor and stood up with her eyes sparkling fire and her nostrils wide. Her mouth was open and her bright teeth glared at me. Her knuckles were white. "People don't talk like that to me," she said thickly. I sat there and grinned at her. Very slowly she closed her mouth and looked down at the spilled liquor. She sat down on the edge of the chaise longue and cupped her chin in one hand. "My God, you big, dark, handsome brute, I ought to throw a Buick at you." I snicked a match on my thumbnail and for once it lit. I puffed smoke into the air and waited. "I loathe masterful men," she said. "I simply loathe them." "Just what is it you're afraid of, Mrs. Regan?" Her eyes whitened, then they darkened until they seemed to be all pupil. Her nostrils looked pinched. Sherwood's younger daughter, Carmen, looks at Marlowe with slate-gray eyes that had almost no expression. A little later, Marlowe comes across Carmen, sitting alone, posing before a camera in a room with a dead man lying on the floor. On a sort of low dais at one end of the room, there was a high-backed teak-wood chair in which Miss Carmen Sternwood was sitting on a fringed orange shawl. She was sitting very straight, with her hands on the arms of the chair, her knees close together, her body stiffly erect in the pose of an Egyptian goddess. Her chin level, her small, bright teeth shining between her parted lips. Her eyes were wide open. The dark slate color of the iris had devoured the pupil. They were mad eyes. She seemed to be unconscious, but she didn't have the pose of unconsciousness. She looked as if, in her mind, she was doing something very important and making a fine job of it. Out of her mouth came tinny, chuckling noises, which didn't change her expression or even move her lips. She was wearing a pair of long jade earrings. They were nice earrings and had probably cost a couple of $100. She wasn't wearing anything else. She had a beautiful body, small, lithe, compact, firm, rounded. Her skin, in the lamplight, had the shimmering luster of a pearl. Her legs didn't quite have the raffish grace of Mrs. Regan's legs, but they were very nice. I looked her over without either embarrassment or ruttishness. As a naked girl, she was not there in that room at all. She was just a dope. To me, she was always just a dope. I listened to the rain hitting the roof and the north windows. Beyond was no other sound, no cars, no siren, just the rain beating. I went over to the sofa and peeled off my trench coat and pawed through the girl's clothes. There was a pale green rough wool dress of the pull-on type with half sleeves. I thought I might be able to handle it. I decided to pass up her underclothes, not from feelings of delicacy, but because I couldn't see myself putting her pants on and snapping her brassiere. I took the dress over to the teak chair on the dais. Miss Sternwood smelled of ether also, at a distance of several feet. The tinny, chuckling noise was still coming from her, and a little froth oozed down her chin. I slapped her face. She blinked and stopped chuckling. I slapped her again. "Come on," I said brightly. "Let's be nice. Let's get dressed." She peered at me, her slaty eyes as empty as holes in a mask. "Go to hell," she said. I slapped her around a little more. She didn't mind the slaps. They didn't bring her out of it. I set to work with the dress. She didn't mind that either. She let me hold her arms up, and she spread her fingers out wide as if that was cute. I got her hands through the sleeves, pulled the dress down over her back, and stood her up. She fell into my arms, giggling. I set her back in the chair and got her stockings and shoes on her. "Let's take a little walk," I said. "Let's take a nice little walk."
Tell me to be discreet for all intended purposes. future he goes unrecognized. All I feel is heat and flame, and all I see are a dark eyes. Oh, the French girl sees in and a drunken man is at the wheel. Hunger pays a heavy price to the falling gods of speed and steel. Oh, time is short and the days are sweet, and passion rules the arrow that flies. A million faces at my feet, but all I see are a dark
That was Bob Dylan's Dark Eyes from the Empire Burlesque album. These eyes, like the eyes of the Sternwoods, are devoid of light. They look at the world but are unseeing. The speaker can see, but what he sees is nothing coming back to him that is alive or vibrant. He lives in a wasteland that is not his own world. It's a world where life and death are memorized. Nobody sees for himself, but their dead, dark eyes see only what they've been told to see. He, however, can hear another drum beating for the dead that rise, a drum of hope in transformation and resurrection, and he can feel nothing for their game where beauty goes unrecognized. All he feels is heat and flame, and all he sees are dark eyes. This could be the song of Dante in hell, or Philip Marlowe having to deal with the Sternwoods, alive himself and living in hope, but surrounded by the dead eyes of the damned. Well, we're coming towards the end of the show this evening, under lamplight, and we cannot end quite so bleakly. Well, here's an interesting poem by Robert Louis Stevenson called Now Bare to the Beholder's Eye. At first it can seem like some sort of voyeur picture, as the speaker watches intently as the woman undresses before him. But there's nothing prurient here. There's something very sensual about the discarded clothes lying on the floor, still retaining the faded warmth and lingering print of the woman's body. The Victorian lady has to dress in layers of uncomfortable, confining clothing. Every day she has to go from a state of natural undress to the condition of a fully dressed woman to play her part in society. But at the end of the day, she reverses the process and sheds inhumanities away by taking off her clothes. It's a kind of glorious liberation of the self after the labors and duties of the day. We all do this to some degree. We all become unaccommodated man, as King Lear calls himself, as he strips off all his clothes on the heath. But most of us today do not undergo quite the same degree of liberation as these Victorian ladies, as they lay by the lady's name and re-become a living woman, revealing the more soft and secret her. The image is actually that of a soldier. In the morning, the bugle calls and the woman must put on her battle gear of floral hues and scents, using clothes as a citadel to protect or defend herself. But at night, the duty is over. She can come off guard and let her body and herself flourish and laugh far from the social engagements. Now bear to the beholder's eye your late denuded bindings lie, subsiding slowly where they fell, a disinvested citadel. The obdurate corset, Cupid's foe, the Dutchman's breeches frilled below, those that the lover notes to note, and white and crackling petticoat. From these that on the ground repose, their lady lately re-arose, and laying by the lady's name, a living woman re-became. Of her that from the public eye they do enclose and fortify, now lying scattered as they fell, an indiscreeter tale they tell, of that more soft and secret her, whose day-long fortresses they were, by fading warmth, by lingering print, these now discarded scabbards hint. A twofold change the ladies know. First in the morn the bugles blow, and they, with floral hues and scents, man their beribboned battlements. But let the stars appear, and they shed inhumanities away. And from the changeling fashion see, through comic and through sweet degree, in nature's toilet unsurpassed, forth leaps the laughing girl at last. Our eyes have beheld the laughing girl at last, the woman's youthful joyous self, released from social constraints, as we all hope to be released, each night if possible, but at least every now and then, and certainly at the very end. And as we all hope, we may be seen by those we treasure, our true selves, naked and unsurpassed. Sight is now a metaphor for perceiving the deepest truths. At the climax of his ordeals, when he finally realizes that he can never see God or see God's reasons for things, Job makes the astounding confession, "I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee." We can know of the truth through hearsay, as others have experienced it, but only once we have experienced it ourselves can we say that we actually see it. Only then can any truth be said to lie bare to the beholder's eye. And if we cannot quite see it yet, at least we can train our eyes to look out for more hopeful times. The road that I follow calls me on my way. Got my eyes on tomorrow and my feet on today. That's the only way, I think. Feet grounded, spirit extended. And let Miriam Makeba lead us out with her great anthem, Eyes on Tomorrow. This has been Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge's Community Radio, Cambridge 105, with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson. Thanking you for joining us here this evening and looking forward to sharing more with you next time. And now, I pass you over to Miriam Makeba, who has her eyes set right.
Something here. people's fears.